The president takes his pen to the Affordable Care Act last week.
And our friends from the Trump Report join us for a panel discussion.
Also, a Run for Something endorsed candidate in Detroit, millennial Garland Gilchrist II, is here to discuss his campaign for city clerk. It's Tuesday, October 17th. Welcome to the Political Beat.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to AfterBuzz TV's The Political Beat, the millennial show and podcast, breaking down the latest in Washington and everything that you need to know from around the world. I'm your host, Drexel Hurd.
Wow, that's a big, tall order. Everything from around the world.
Around the world.
Woo!
In 60 minutes, or less than that. I'm your host, Drexel Hurd, the semi-moderate voice of the left. You can follow me on social media at Drexel Hurd.
And I'm Chelsea Galicia, the lefter of the left. You can follow me at Chelsea Galicia.
Some housekeeping items. We know we were scheduled to have Texas Senate candidate Beto O'Rourke this week. We've got a little campaign scheduling, so we're going to get him back on. And then in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Senate Pro Tem Democrat Kevin DeLeon, who is going to be scheduled to come on the show to discuss his campaign against Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Good times.
Yeah.
Only political geeks like us would be this excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be good. First up on today's show, we'll start with the interview with Garland Gilchrist.
And then in the breakdown, we'll discuss the president's decision on the Affordable Care Act and then the follow-up, you know, two-year thingy that is being talked about. It's much better than a thingy, but, you know.
Yeah, and in the spotlight, we're going to highlight another breast cancer organization, as it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, that helps millions of women across the country. But first up, millennials across the country are stepping up to the plate to run for something. A couple of weeks ago, we had Executive Director Amanda Littman on the show to discuss the organization. Over the next few months, we'll be highlighting those endorsed candidates. Today, Run for Something endorsed 37 new candidates.
Today?
Today.
Ooh.
I know.
I didn't know that.
And they're going to come on the show to talk about why they chose to step up and lead, starting with today's interview. He's currently running for city clerk in the city of Detroit. Welcome to the program, Garland Gilchrist II.
Which Drexel loves because he's too.
Thank you for having me. Yes, another second and on the phone, on the line is great. This is a great night.
Thanks for coming on the show. So first off, can you explain to us, because I don't know, and maybe our viewers that don't know, what are the duties of a city clerk?
Sure. So in the city of Detroit, the city clerk has three responsibilities. The first is to manage the voting and elections process. The second is to be the city's official public record keeper, meaning it's the clerk's job to give people information about what the government is doing. And the third is to be the clerk of the city council so that you give citizens, residents, businesses, et cetera, access to the city council and all the decision-making process therein. So really, the way I think about it is it's the city clerk's job to open the doorway to democracy and decision-making in Detroit. And why this is relevant to y'all really is that the elections in Detroit have national consequences. The failure of elections in Detroit, the failure in voter turnout in Detroit is what paved the way for Donald Trump to be the first Republican to win Michigan since 1988. And then Donald Trump winning Michigan made it easier for him to become the president. And now we have to deal with that every single day. And it hurts me that Detroit played a role.
Yikes. Okay. So you are up against a three-term incumbent for this job, which, geez, is a whole lot more important than I even thought it was. How do you plan to sort of overcome the hurdle that can be unseating an incumbent?
Sure. So first, it's really great to have the support of friends and partner organizations like Run for Something. I was actually the first candidate they endorsed outside of the state of Virginia during my primary, which was on August 8th. And my campaign got to the primary even though I was a political newcomer. You know, I've never run for political office before. I'm a millennial. I just turned 35. And I was running in a seven-candidate field of people who all had name recognition. Some of them had been in elected office or had sought elected office a number of times or were just like very prominent activists. And the way that we won was we took it directly to the voters. We contacted people directly in their homes. We recruited more volunteers than any other campaign. I knocked on more doors than all the other candidates combined. We used social media to reach people where they are because, you know, 70% of people in Detroit use Facebook. And so we're taking those same tactics into to the general. You know, before I came home to Detroit, I was national campaign director at MoveOn.org. I recruited 34,000 volunteers for President Obama in 2012. I helped stand up a text message program in 2008. So I'm used to using new tools to pull new people into the political process. And that's exactly what we're doing on a local level, doing things that really haven't ever been seen in the municipal race before. We're the first campaign to do basically phone banking via text message in a city level race. That's happened in state level races. That's what Hustle did for the Bernie campaign and the presidential. We're doing it on a city level for the first time that's ever been happening in the country. And the result is we're able to reach more people more efficiently with more volunteers and more energy than any campaign that really has ever taken place in Detroit. And you need that kind of movement building in order to really unseat an incumbent. And so we're proud, you know, we've been able to build this movement of with more than 500 volunteers for a city clerk's race, a race that y'all don't even know what the position was.
And so I think we kind of knew, like a little bit.
We've been able to get support from donors from 48 states.
Wow.
And so what it shows is that not only is this campaign and this position and the consequence of the position are national in scope, but it means that people understand that it's important. And when people from across the country, across the state, and across the city are looking at the candidate who can change this office, who's most qualified, and who's really has the energy to serve, they're choosing the Gilchrist campaign. I'm really humbled by that.
That's amazing. Wow. So on your website, and I think on your social media, there's a quote that you said, "I've been preparing to be for this my whole life. I've been preparing to be city clerk my whole life." What do you think prepares you, other than, you know, kind of being a grassroots organizer, what do you think prepares you for to step into this role, for a job that clearly is bigger than some people might think? I mean, what prepared you for this role?
Yeah, specifically, the person who serves Detroiters as their city clerk needs to be a problem solver and someone who knows how to fix broken systems. You know, I have two engineering degrees from the University of Michigan in computer engineering and computer science. I worked as a software engineer at Microsoft for 4 years. I know how to fix complex systems. You know, after my activism work on both Obama campaigns as an organizer with the Center for Community Change and the National Campaign Director at MoveOn.org, where I was a voting rights advocate, very effective at fighting and winning campaigns for voting rights all across the country, I came back home to Detroit after my children were born to be a problem solver. I was the Director of Innovation and Emerging Technology for the City of Detroit, which means I was the number two in the technology department. And I fixed broken, complicated systems, like how we fix and manage fire hydrants to how we deliver city services in a more trustworthy way. Well, that kind of problem solving is exactly what we need in the city clerk's office. Now, this time last year, I hadn't thought about running for political office in my career. It wasn't something that was on my radar. But after the failure of an election in November 2016, I had a really bad personal voting experience with my own family, where we had a failed polling location where the voting machines broke. People who worked polls didn't know what to do, and they ran out of paper, and they ran out of pens, and they ran out of things to cover up your ballots. It was a mess. They waited an hour and a half in a low voter turnout election. You know, it became clear to members of the community that I was qualified to fix the broken systems in that office and better serve voters and inform and empower them. So the specific things that I've done in my career and knowing how to fix systems, having the competence and confidence to do so, but also knowing how to mobilize people and engage new people in the political process to recruit new people to come and work for this system and change it for the better, that's what's prepared me. And I hadn't thought about that until people really, came to my wife and I and asked us to consider committing as a family to running for this office. And you know, honestly, the reason we said yes is because, you know, I saw my parents in their volunteer time serve the neighborhood that I grew up in on the east side of Detroit. My mother ran our neighborhood association for 6 years. Both of my parents served in what's called a citizens district council, which is kind of these hyper-local governing bodies in the city of Detroit. And so I saw that as a small child, and I wanted my twin 3-year-olds who just turned 4 on September 25th,
which also happens to be my birthday,
I wanted them to see their father stepping up to serve the community in a way that he was uniquely prepared. And so my wife and I made that commitment, and we're here, and we were not expected to get through the primary by the political establishment. First had us at 2% in virtually unknown, and we got 20% in the primary and came in second place.
That's crazy.
Now we're poised to really make history and unseat an incumbent in the city clerk's office, and I'm excited about it.
So you brought up your family. So how has you you guys are fairly young still. How does that?
Yes.
We watch a lot of political families go through this political machine. How has your family adapted to that? You said that your immediate family has been a part of the political process, but not necessarily your wife. And now you've got these two kids that are like looking at dad, being like, "Hey, why is dad not here?" And he's out.
No, totally. I mean, basically, the reason I almost didn't run for office was because my kids are so young. And, you know, it would mean that daddy would need to be gone basically every night for virtually a year.
Right.
And that is an insane proposition for 2-3-year-olds. And I was the person, I'd take my kids to school every day, and I relieved our childcare every day and started dinner. So that was something that was really a big transition for our family. But my wife's a superhero. We've been married 8 years. Our anniversary was this past July. My wife actually just ran the Detroit Free Press Marathon on Sunday. Wow, she was training for a marathon while this was happening, so I married a legitimate bona fide superhero. And it's been, actually, we dove in. It's been great. You know, we wouldn't have done this if we didn't think there was a path to victory, and we're following that path. And my kids have really embraced it. My son's favorite shirt is his campaign t-shirt, he told me. And we have a bunch of chants that we made up for the Labor Day March in Detroit. And like my children will sometimes randomly break out and they'll say like, fired up, standing tall, fired
right.
up.
Move tall, over, twinkle, twinkle, like little stars. So we got a better song.
Really, we say standing tall pretty short. That's my tagline. I'm 6'8", so I'm really tall. And so we try to be really on the nose with that. And but the children really enjoy it. And so we've embraced it as a family. We're not the first people who had young children that won for office before. Somehow others figured it out. We knew that we could figure it out, too, because this was important. Empowering and informing Detroiters so that they could be, you know, have full impact on the decision-making processes that impact their lives every day was really important to us, and we really felt like I was uniquely qualified to serve.
Speaking of your city, Detroit gets dumped on a lot by Republicans. It's Detroit or Chicago. What would you say to people who just say Detroit is just a failing city?
I would say that it doesn't help when the city is a national embarrassment for not being able to count votes properly. And I would say that we need to counter that with better leadership overall. And I think for people who have a generally negative narrative about Detroit, I mean, that's grounded in a lot of unfortunate things. Bad headlines due to narrow storytelling, due to racism straight up, because it's still the blackest city in the country, a city that's had its share of problems, but also has probably the lion's share of problem solvers in the state of Michigan who have been doing this on a very local level every day trying to make ends meet. And I think it's important that people get a chance to hear and see and feel their stories. So I'm always encouraging people who have something negative to say to Detroit, ask them to see, well, have you even tried to understand anything in a different narrative? Have you ever tried to understand anything that was different and positive? You know, when I moved out of the state after college, I found myself being like the chief Detroit advocate was my official job title. I wasn't a software engineer or anything like that. I was actually the chief Detroit advocate. And that came to a head actually in 2011. I actually started an organization when I was living in D.C. called Detroit Diaspora. And the whole premise of the organization was to get Detroiters who lived in these other cities, because the chief export of Detroiters was people who wanted to go build their careers in other places. And so we actually brought people together in those other cities to tell their Detroit stories and encourage them actually to consider being useful to Detroit in some way. And my secret goal was to get everybody to move back home. And I was happy to ultimately do that myself with my own family in 2014.
Well, it's not secret anymore. So everybody head on back to Detroit.
Yeah. Well, the cat is out of the bag.
Cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, I need to come home, real. we're ready for you.
Last question. So something that we ask at least all the candidates that we've had on the show so far. What are your top three priorities for your city, and how do you plan on accomplishing them?
Yeah, the first one is we have important elections coming up in Detroit and in the state of Michigan in 2018. And beyond the midterm elections, we have a senator on the ballot, and we have our congressional races. We also have a gubernatorial race in Michigan, and we have state legislative races. We have judges, we have ballot initiatives, one that's hopefully going to be on the ballot for gerrymandering. So some very important things. So I'm going to be laser focused on increasing voter turnout in 2018. Our election in this past August had less than 14% voter turnout. The presidential election in Detroit had 41% voter turnout. Those are those numbers indicate failure and a lack of confidence in the Detroit city clerk and the person who's responsible for elections. So my priorities are going to be making sure that voting is easy and convenient. One, making sure people are voting at the polling place that's closest to where they live. Some people live across the street or two doors down from a polling place. get vote 2 miles away in Detroit. We need to make that more convenient. The second is using research-proven methods to increase turnout, like having people make election day plans and encouraging them to do so, giving them templates to do so, using media, social media, billboards, et cetera, to get people to understand and make a decision for what time they're going to vote on election day before election day. As you give you a concrete example, 70% of people in Detroit use Facebook, but our current Department of Elections has not updated its Facebook page since September 11th, 2013. That's before my children were born. So people who go to Facebook every day are not able to get information about voter registration deadlines, election day reminders, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is making sure that people actually are, you know, 99% of people in Detroit have a cell phone that can receive a text message. So research shows that if a person gets a text message reminder within 2 days of election day that reminds them of the election day and tells them where their polling location is, they're more likely to actually go and vote mm-hmm. because they received and read that text message. Well, when I was working as director of innovation for the city, I procured the system that the city government uses to receive to send text messages to residents. The current city clerk does not utilize that platform. And so I'm going to make sure that we're using that to demonstrate how we can use research-proven methods to increase voter turnout and get more people engaged and get more people registered starting next year.
Well, that sounds like a plan.
I'm excited for the city of Detroit.
I am fired up and standing tall.
No doubt.
Well played, Drexel. Well played.
I wrote it down so I would remember. So we'll leave it right there. I know you got to get back out there and win this thing. So
absolutely.
Thanks for joining us on today's show. And
we'll have you back on to hear your success stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Election day is November 7th. People can, if they want more information, can check me out at gilchristforcityclerk.com. Or on Facebook at gilchristforcityclerk. You can donate at the website. I'm on @blue, and you know we want to continue to really show that change is possible, that revolution is possible, and I'm happy to have the support from people all across the country to build a movement for participation in Detroit.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Carlin.
Good luck on the campaign trail, sir.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Woo!
Wow, that was good. I think he's going to run for Congress. I do not doubt. He sounds like a congressman.
I mean, he is on it.
Yeah, it's good.
I don't even know if you can, like, train somebody to be that good.
Yeah.
He just...
Especially for a new candidate. And it was just good. It was just
good.
There
was no talking in circles, right. no obvious pivots to something totally different from the question. I mean, he answered the question and then brought in the other things that he right. wanted to. I mean, he is a pro.
Yeah. You know who's not a pro? Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah, he's not a pro. Not a pro at anything, actually. let's talk about what's been going on. So,
yes, in the breakdown.
Yeah, the Trump administration is very good at confusing the shit out of Americans by dumping major policy changes.
It's written right
It's here. Written. Guys, we write a script every week that says that right in the script. Major policy changes at the end of the week so that no one can pay attention. It's very hard for me to, like, on Fridays, I'm like, what are we going to get today? First off, that's another authoritarian move.
Fridays are the days of the authoritarian.
Well, just putting it all out at the same time. Like
and waiting until the end of the week.
Waiting until we all cannot pay attention and it's all coming to a head. So it's definitely something that people should be concerned about. Last week, healthcare. We know the Republicans have tried everything under the sun to get the Affordable Care Act repealed, and it keeps getting thwarted by what I'm going to call the Democrats' Scooby-Doo and the gang.
But does that include McCain and...
Yeah. I can include them, too. Huh. Mitch McConnell is like the guy with the, you know, who gets the mask taken off, and then John McCain and the Democrats come in, and they thwart him.
Oof. Trump wasn't going to take that.
No.
Laying down.
He frustrated with the inaction of Congress to repeal the Obamacare. Obamacare signed an executive order to stop payments to insurance companies from the Department of Health and Human Services. We all know that the ACA created a subsidy system for low and some middle income families to help in the purchase of insurance on state insurance exchange. The law set a cap on the amount of insurance premiums that individuals and families will have to pay for the second cheapest silver plan based upon that person's family income in relation to the federal poverty level. So let's bring in our friends from the Trump Report to discuss this. You all know Mr. Scott Moore from the Trump Report. He's been on the show before when it was like political culture. It was a whole different ballgame.
Don't confuse people.
And the first...
I'm confused.
And I think the first time on today's show...
Yes.
Ms. Brooks Elise Taylor, welcome
Thank
to
you
the
guys.
Show.
Thanks.
Thank you for having
welcome
us.
Welcome to the new studio. It's a little chilly in here.
I like it,
though. It's like an icebox.
It
looks like
it's nice for me.
We were talking about how, before we went on, that the last time the three of us, Drexel, Scott, and I were in this room, bad things were happening.
Bad things. But
yeah. Get your mind out of the gutter. Yeah. That was election night.
It was like it was a crazy
it was
crazy
awful.
Night. So listen, let's talk about this. So I want to know from you, Scott. Let's start with you. Why is it that Republicans despise American families?
Why despise everything about
American
families?
Why do they hate Americans and American families?
It's not so much their hate for Americans and American families as much as their hate for Obama and anything that he did. Mm-hmm. So they would rather, you know, destroy health insurance for American families than take anything that Obama did and go with it.
So in turn, hating American
families. Yes, but as a byproduct of that,
and
of that hatred to Obama.
Do we know how many people would be affected if the subsidies were withdrawn?
Oh, it was the CBO did, and it was going to be several million, and also the instability of the markets from getting rid of those subsidies, too, would raise premiums by even more for everybody. And it would also further destabilize the economy just in general because, you know, this whole thing they've been doing has not been thought out. And all they want to do is repeal because that's what they're going after with their base.
It reminds me of, like, the game Jenga. Like, they're going to pull out each piece.
And that's what they're
doing.
They
don't know the one that's going to cause the whole thing to topple over.
Yeah.
So something last week that Donald Trump said, and we're going to talk about this press conference here in a second, but he made a comment about why he feels – somebody asked him, are you going to redo everything that the President Obama has – of the Obama administration, last administration has put forth? And his answer was so simple. Like I was – you know, it's one of those things
he said yes.
He said yes. And he said yes because he was like, well, it's a new administration. And in his head, a new leader means complete turnover of policies. Brooke, what do you think about that?
Oh, goodness. He doesn't know left from right these days. First, Obamacare is dead. It's dying. It's dead. It's on the floor. It's DOA. And now we have these subsidies that are going to keep everything alive for the next 2 years. We know it's about Trump's ego and need for control. And that's why, like you guys mentioned, he just wants to be sure that anything that has Obama's name on it is kaput.
But do you think
obviously.
He would do that?
I don't think he has the ability because he doesn't even have the wherewithal to know everything that Obama's done.
Well, I mean, somebody
nobody tells him.
Exactly.
Stephen Miller
keep some of those
is
orders
the,
like under the table.
We
you
know Stephen Miller's in the White House line iteming everything. Find out what Obama did. But
exactly.
do you think that in that respect that Donald Trump would do that had he had a Republican predecessor? Like, with the idea of...
No, I don't. I actually don't. I think that, well, depending on his relationship with that predecessor.
Like if it was McCain.
Well, if it was McCain, then yes.
Or Romney.
Yes.
Or Mitt Romney.
But I think it would more so depend on that relationship and if it was ongoing and if that predecessor is, like, kind of kissing his ass still now that he's president. Like, as long as you're kind of stroking, I don't want to say the word, but then, you know, he's more apt to look the other way. But it seems like he just wants to show his political power and destroy everything in his path so that he can create anew, when in reality, you know, he doesn't really know what he's doing. And can I say this really quickly before we go on?
Sure.
The guy that you guys just spoke to,
yeah.
Garland, the most eloquent, well-spoken, yes. intelligent man. I do foresee this man
know,
going
yeah.
very, very
I want to run for Congress
and
now.
6'8", I had to say something. I mean, I was listening... 6'8", that's amazing.
You had to
yeah,
say something
you're like,
about
yeah.
No, his height, I love tall men. I know you're married, Garland, but not saying that.
I'm married, and I love tall men.
I just foresee this man going very, very far in the political process and whatever it
yeah.
is that he does. Like, that is the way a president should be speaking.
That is
right.
True.
Oh, he was great.
And you know, I've heard they say, I don't know if this is true, maybe Scott, like the historian, can tell us, that every time in the presidential election, whoever the taller mm-hmm. candidate is wins.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Statistics
yeah.
show that
yep.
even with
that's
getting
accurate?
A job.
Yes, it is.
All right, well.
Yeah, same thing with a job. Yep.
Even with a job, you're more,
you make more money
in general, the taller you are,
interesting.
The more money you make.
This sucks.
Well, you know who left too. The other tall person in... The other tall person in the room the other day was Mitch McConnell. The
oh,
president
boy.
Had a they had a meeting, and then they had an impromptu press conference. So let's talk about the relationship between Congress and the executive branch real quick. So do you guys feel that the Obama administration on health care, do you guys think that the Obama administration sidestepped Congress to get these paid out? Like, we know that Congress never appropriated the money directly, but and that the executive branch – paid for these subsidies out of the HHS budget. Once money is appropriated, do you guys think that the executive branch has the authority to move money however they feel like it?
Ooh, the lawyer in me doesn't know the answer to this one, and I'm a little reluctant to even take a stab at it because it feels like it's one of those things that's clear, yes or no, but probably if you took a look at the text, we would have no idea. It would have to be litigated. I don't know. You got it?
I'm asking because I think there is a legal argument out there that it is illegal. There's obviously the Trump administration believes, at least their Justice Department has ruled that it is illegal, and this is why they've stopped the payments in the first place, because they feel like the executive branch does not have the power. And the Obama administration sidestepped Congress, and Congress wanted to be a part of the process. And then, but we all know that the time that Congress, we talked about last week, or we talked about in the Trump report, which was once they got to the point where Affordable Care Act was being executed, Republicans had basically already taken over the Congress at that point. So they certainly were going to appropriate money to cover subsidies that they didn't vote for in the first place.
I think it's a gray area, but let's be honest, what the Trump administration is doing is purely political. It's a gray area, but the fact that they hate everything about Obamacare, they want to do everything, like Chelsea was saying with the Jenga game, like everything they can do to start poking at it and pulling parts of it out to make sure that it fails and implodes on itself. Because if you were just to step back and do a nonpartisan look at it all, and if Congress was really not going to be so gridlocked and partisan and really was going to look in the best ways to keep the best parts of Obamacare afloat and really come with a bipartisan plan, I think they would have a better agreement on, you know, where this money should be allocated and who should be responsible for it. But I think it is definitely a gray area as far as the stepping back nonpartisan, how the law is set up, as far as what the executive branch can and cannot do.
So earlier I was talking about this two-year thingy that a couple of senators had put together, and what it actually is a bipartisan deal. So far, it's just these two senators, Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, who have agreed to it. We have no idea if the House would go for this. But their idea...
We know that the House would never,
never go for it. I would say that, too. I would say likely they would never go for it.
I mean,
they're non-committal right now.
There are some that seem to be standing and saying, hey, okay, we'll go ahead and implement this so that we, you know, reduce the instability and chaos. But we're still working on repealing the ACA.
It kind of allows them to save face.
Yeah, exactly. That's why they're doing it. That's the only reason.
So that might be the reason why they go for it, because this is not the permanent solution. We are still committed to repealing.
But
not
I don't
actually.
See, here's what I say about that, though. Conservatives, if you listen to conservatives like Rand Paul, Mike Lee, some of those conservatives in the Senate, and then there's a lot more conservatives in the House
who have this
fiscal responsibility mindset.
What they call fiscal responsibility.
Right, what they believe fiscal responsibility. So I'm a little skeptical of House members because they run every other – basically
years.
They're basically
constantly
every
always
year,
running.
Constantly always running. That they would be interested in voting for something when they've been touting not having the federal government pay for things. So if the federal government is still going to pay for these things, what is stopping these House members from wanting to vote for this?
I think that the reason they might is because this looks like at an attempt to bolster the power of the states and, you know, Republicans and their states' rights thing. So their spin is that the federal government is getting out of health care by just giving the states money so that the states can run their own programs, and therefore they come out looking like the states' rights guy.
Here's my argument on both sides in a way, because I will say that I agree with what you're saying, Drexel, because of the fact that the House can be a lot more partisan, like extreme, because they're in gerrymandered districts. They only have to appeal to their really extreme base, like Trump always does and pretends like the extreme base is everywhere and he's going to win again. But they really can. And so they have less of a reason to be more moderate, whereas the Senate has to deal with statewide and they have to be more moderate and they have to kind of appease their entire state population. So for them, it's a lot harder to take the risk. And that's why we saw the House vote for repealing Obamacare the first time around, because they have less to lose than the Senate does.
Okay, but let me try arguing with that. Isn't it true that the subsidies that are being pulled would affect the poorer states, many of them Republican? So these people, once they realize that it would affect them, will show up in hordes to their town halls.
Yeah, that's what you'd like to think. That's what I'd like to think.
In a perfect
yes.
world, well, you would think that.
I was yes. going to say an idealist like view is that these representatives realize that pulling those subsidies would mean that the lower class, those who are in poverty, for example, would end up having to get on welfare, get more tax help.
Oh, there you go.
Right?
It's going to be more expensive.
It's going to be more expensive in the long run, if they're thinking wisely. And the middle class won't be able to get that help from the government because they're middle class, and they're going to be the ones that are pissed and will show up and demand some help, and that they're thinking long term, maybe?
That's my only, and then we're going to move on to tax cuts here in a second. My only argument with that is that the Republican argument is never about helping the American family so much as it is keeping the federal government out of spending,
right.
Out of spending all this money. So their argument has never been, well, I want to do this so that you don't have to spend more money on the other side. Well, we know they're going to spend more money on the other side regardless. You take the subsidies away, they're going to have to spend more money. Mm-hmm. So they can't argue that – what, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I agree. Giving the states more flexibility holds more weight for them, I'm sure. And I'm sure that's one of the primary reasons. But yeah.
Well, and my last thing I would just say is the only reason why I think that the House members may jump at voting is if they realize that the instability of letting these subsidies die is going to add too much of a mess that voters are now blaming Republicans for the healthcare debacle. It's no longer Obamacare. Mm-hmm. It's now squarely Republicans. And if they feel that's too much of a risk, that they will definitely jump on board and try to save the subsidies. That's the only way I can see that actually happening.
Well, hopefully Democrats will fix that messaging problem and figure out a better way to spin it in the Democrats' favor, which, you know, Patty Murray's been working on this forever, and so has Lamar Alexander, and, you know, hopefully we'll see what happens. But the other big thing that Congress has, because Congress has a big plate. I know they only get one scoop of ice cream in the Trump White House, but they got
who
a big
plate.
Who
eats ice cream on a plate?
First thing that occurred to me.
I know.
But tax cuts coming up. See, do you guys think it's going to pass this year?
No.
Even after today? So
this is the first time that I agree with Mitch McConnell. I mean, he didn't overtly come out and say it wasn't, but I don't think it will.
But today, John McCain, Ted Cochran's is back in the Senate now. He was on medical leave for a little bit, which kind of hurt the Republican numbers a little bit. And then John McCain came out today and said that he would vote for the budget because they have to pass the budget to get to tax cuts. So it's kind of their first step in doing that. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is giving a speech today on tax reform, which every time he gets up there, I don't think he has a clue of what he's talking about.
He was like, are you doing tax cuts or tax reform? No, we are doing tax cuts.
Right.
Three sentences later, we're doing tax cuts and tax reform.
Right.
You're reforming something.
So what do you guys think, Brooke, what do you think is the best way to get the message across that no American family benefits from these tax cuts?
From the ones proposed.
From the ones being proposed.
Well, the Koch family does.
Yeah, sure. The ones at the top.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Certainly. So
the
you
Waltons.
Mean,
Trumps.
The Trumps. What you asked me what would be the best.
How do you think the Democrats should
Trump
this.
Is, I mean, just, you know, over and over repeating, this is good for the middle class. This is good for Americans. You are going to be paying less in taxes. And it's just not true. So
it's
how
so
do we
hard
say it in a way that they can hear it?
The middle American or the average American to understand the way not only our tax system works, but how it all affects everything within our governmental system. So maybe finding a way to simplify it for Americans so they really understand what that means and what that entails for.
How about it looks like it's going to be lowered,
exactly.
But in
we
reality,
might have to bring
it's
out,
not.
Like, we right. might have to bring out, like, actual pictures.
That was like the
maybe
outdoor
a PowerPoint.
Charts.
We need to Schoolhouse Rock.
Yes.
Schoolhouse Rock.
I think
for
lots of animation. We should
if
do that.
If the DNC rolled out Schoolhouse Rock versions of messages.
It would be great if they did. Bring
it
back
would work.
Schoolhouse
it would help
Rock.
Trump. He could figure like what the Iran nuclear deal is.
He
know
might,
how signing a bill.
The difference between the Persian
might,
Gulf and the Arabian Gulf. That's what he called the Persian Gulf.
he might flip to be a Democrat once he figures out that it's not helping people like he thought it was going to.
They can keep him.
Really you're saying how do you truly educate America? Because
right.
we aren't all... as
but I,
we bring this show far and wide.
I know, but right. I will say the only good thing is, and you know, a lot of people are like, oh, polling is off and everything, but the way the tax reform, tax cut, whatever you want to call it, looks today, a majority of Americans do not support it.
Right, because they realize that they're being lied to?
No, they don't support this present form.
Is it because they realize that the president's lying to them, or...
I think it's because people are actually looking at it and seeing that it's not going to help middle class families like it looks like it's going to help. It's going to be helping the you know 1%, and so the majority, just like when they were trying to repeal Obamacare, the majority of Americans did not support it. So not to say it won't pass, but the good news is at least some people are paying attention, and those people are not for it in its present form. And that's why I don't think it's going to pass this year, because I think by the time they can come up to an agreement of such a big colossal thing, it's just they're going to run out of time.
And it'll be July, and there'll right, be an election, and they're not going right. to want to do it. So, okay, so I want to ask everybody real quick. So we know, we just talked about where Republicans are. Let's talk about the Republican mindset real quick. I'm going to have to reach way back to early 2000. Do you guys...
Don't hurt yourself.
Do you guys think that... Because we talk about... You know, we know that Republicans and conservatives don't like to hear that they're voting against their... Mm-hmm.
Best interest. Yeah.
They just don't like to hear that. So obviously there needs to be a different message from Democrats to get that point across. But do you guys... I feel like Republican voters don't vote for the economic message that Republicans put out there. Is it... the social aspects of and the civil rights aspects of the Republicans are putting out there that you guys, that Republican voters are voting for these people?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, there is a lot of that. Absolutely.
But I think that they're also being sold that the trickle-down theory, the Republican conservative model for success in the economy and employment, I mean, people are still buying it.
There is some of that, but yes.
It goes back to that point that I've made before, and I know we've all talked about before, that morality, or that idea that Americans are inherently good, that we believe that if you give money back to the company is going to do for us what we've been told to do.
Right.
And we've seen that has not happened. So how do you remind these people that the companies aren't going to be there for you? Just because if we give tax cuts to corporations, you're not going to see that money. How do you remind people that they're not going to see that money at all? Because it's got to go back into shareholders. Shareholders come first.
Right, before the company.
In companies.
It's a hard line because you don't even have that. But look, you're going back to Drexel. There are people that fear the changing demographics in this country and the globalization of this country. And, you know, Trump and a lot of the Republican candidates were speaking to them about this Making America Great Again and sort of this nationalistic approach. And for a lot of these people, especially in rural areas – and in manufacturing and blue-collar jobs, they're kind of fearful of the other, and they're fearful of the changes that are happening so fast, where the urban areas are already there and moving forward and kind of embracing this globalization because there's just more diversity and more economic stuff is happening with other countries and other places. But for the rest of the country, there's still a little bit of that fear of that unknown, and in a way, the Republicans are still selling that, like, we're putting you first, and, you know, we're number one, and... everything's great,
we're
and just
return
follow
you
us
to the good old days.
To the good old days, gosh. And whatever that is for you, if that's the 1950s. So there is some of that of those undertones going on, besides just the economic message, and that's the hard thing for the Democrats now, is to be able to bridge that gap with the working white class people in the rural areas, with the movement of the urban diverse. And it's hard to get both of those sides there, and that's going to be a challenge for Democrats just moving forward in some midterms and everything, how you can appeal to sort of both of those sides there.
Yeah. Brooke, I want to talk, because we were talking, you mentioned something earlier about foreign policy. I just want to real quick get your thoughts on the president's comments on President Obama and past presidents calling the families of fallen soldiers.
Well, I love, first of all, that he was just fact-checked in present time. He said that, right?
Right.
And then someone spoke up and said, so are you saying that Obama did not call any families? And he's like, well, and then he's stuttering over his words. Well, I heard that he didn't, but he probably did. I mean, I'm sure he did. I heard that he had called some families, not that many. He doesn't do it that often. God. I mean, that was the succession. We saw the lie unfold and then him backtrack entirely. And we know that that's not true. We saw Obama visit families of fallen soldiers right. when that happened. I mean, this person is, I think he's just, he lies so much that it just is second nature to him now. And I think that he begin, you know, when you lie so
but
much,
is it, but do you think
you
he's lying?
Believe your lies.
Do you think that he's lying, or do you think that he's just regurgitating things that he's heard? Because he did say, I was told that
his,
this.
No,
so he
his,
just hears it on the way
I
out
think
the
that's
door.
A lie, too. I think his M.O. is
Where's
just
he getting this
other people. Is belittling other people so that he can make himself look better. It's the whole, let me make myself look like the better, more empathetic.
Because how many times has he said the phrase, people are saying,
right.
when no people are saying
exactly.
the next words that come out of his mouth?
But it came out today that President Obama may or may not have called General Kelly when General Kelly's son died. So I feel like Donald Trump heard a story in the White House that, I don't know if President Obama called General Kelly or General Kelly only got a signed letter from the president, because we know President Obama liked to write a lot. And so maybe he heard that story and then, like, he thought that that would bridge the gap between him and General Kelly, and, like, it was going
to
become a
thing. I think he's been talking to the president of the Virgin Islands too much yeah. in his head is what he's been doing.
Yeah.
himself.
Can I want to get, like, 10-second thought, Scott. There was an ambush in Niger of 4 soldiers. Trump hasn't said much about
right.
it. I haven't heard very much
no,
said, but is this perhaps the next Benghazi?
Well, I was just going to say, when are they going to open up the investigation
exactly.
into the Niger attacks here? Because it is it's absolutely horrible what happened. And the fact that he was talking about former presidents not calling when we lost 4 service members that paid the ultimate sacrifice, I mean, it's horrendous. It's horrible.
Right.
And
there were others
again,
injured
so,
too,
yes,
besides the 4 who
yeah.
died.
And it's and this pettiness, and again, like you said, then where's the investigation here?
Well, we know
horrible.
Who's not going to investigate, and that's going to be Congress.
Right.
They're not going to do anything about it. Well, listen, that's all the time that we have for a panel discussion right now. You guys have to come back because I do want to talk in the next few weeks about the opioid crisis and, of course,
cool.
trade. We got to have a big conversation about trade.
Opioid
is going to be good.
We've got to talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
What we got in the spotlight?
We have one other? Is this the last? No, this is not the last
week.
Okay. But this week, we are spotlighting Support Connection, Inc., because they're a not-for-profit organization that provides emotional, educational, and social support for families and friends affected by breast and ovarian cancer.
Yep. You guys can check it out at supportconnection.org. For more information, we threw up the splash page for you guys to see. Great show. Thanks to Garland Gilchrist II for coming on today's show. As always, we love your viewer feedback and listeners, so continue to leave your comments on the thoughts and show below. Before we go, though, last week our engineer, Steven, said that he loves pumpkin. So I went and got him some pumpkin spice
nice.
Flavor creamed Oreos because we talked about it last week, of course. So thanks, Steven, for making us look good every week.
Are you trying to kill him?
Don't forget to check out the This Is Us after show that's coming on later tonight on Tuesdays, the Survivor after show on Wednesdays, and get the latest.
Did we get a live read from this company?
No.
Okay.
But
we will not be showing that.
And then get the latest on what to put on your DVR daily with the DVR report. Be sure to follow AfterBuzz TV on all social media to find out when your favorite shows are on.
Thanks,
we'll see you all next week.
Bye now.
Bye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.